Please stand and hear the gospel, which comes from Luke chapter 24. Now that same day, the two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter the glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going further. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, it is nearly evening, the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, "It is true, the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. And now would you please pray with me as we send our children and youth off to their lessons. Go in peace, grow in mind and in body, and grow in the knowledge that you are loved by God and by his people. Amen.
And off they go. It's good to see everyone. Good morning. It is good to be with you. This is, as Jed said, the third Sunday of Easter, and this morning, I do want to talk about that response of those two men on the road to Emmaus, that question that they asked, that beautiful question, did not our hearts burn within us when Jesus was with us? I want to give you fair warning, though. We are going to be taking the scenic route to that question today. We are going to wind around on some back roads before we meet up with our friends on the road to Emmaus this morning, because I want to arrive there through a very particular path. This week, I read an article, always dangerous reading in general, but I read an article about the faith-based AI tech boom that has arrived. And in particular, I learned that for $2 a minute, you can now chat with your very own personal Jesus. This is Chatbot Jesus. He's a pretty shiny guy. You can chat with Jesus just any old day of the week if you've got green money in your pocket. I have been thinking about Chatbot Jesus some this week, I have to say. I've really been thinking about the implications of Chatbot Jesus, and really a world in which there is a market for such a product. And that's what it is, right? It's a product. In particular, what is it that a person wants from this encounter? And, you know, I've given it some thought. I've sort of dug in a little bit. And I'm beginning to suspect I don't think this is good. In fact, I think I'm willing to even go so far as I think it's pretty bad, actually. I think it's pretty bad. I know that this is the kind of theological insight that you guys show up for. This is the kind of heavy-hitting, decisive stuff. Your big takeaway this morning, pay-to-pray robot Jesus, probably not good. 0 out of 10, do not recommend. This is a strange reality, or maybe unreality, for us to be confronted with. And that actually shouldn't surprise us, right? In the passage that my lovely wife, Emily, just read, Peter says, we are sojourners, we are foreigners here, right? We should not be surprised then when things are presented to us that we find very strange and disorienting and out of keeping with the way we think things ought to be. Very early in our relationship with a family of Syrian refugees, we were going out with them, we were doing something or other, and we took with us peanut butter sandwiches. We were gonna share these sandwiches with them because we thought, what is the most basic, boring, bland thing that a person can have, right, that's just, it's fine. And that made sense to us, peanut butter sandwiches. But to a non-Western palate, peanut butter is actually real weird. Like, it's a weird texture, it's a pretty weird taste. They were very grossed out by peanut butter sandwiches. They did not think that these were normal food items to be given. And so in the same way for us, as strangers here in this place, we should not be surprised when the world presents something to us with a straight face as completely normal, an ordinary part of the world, and we say, actually, that's pretty gross. Actually, I find that very distasteful. I was driving down I-35 a few weeks ago, and there was a billboard that said, it was an ad for a dentist, it said, are your teeth sexy enough? As if that was a question that had been rolling around in my head all day. As if through the normal course of my life, I wonder that from time to time. It kind of did make me ask, right? It kind of did make, like, are they? I mean, I think of my teeth as having a certain rugged devil-may-care sort of thing, but this is a different question. Like, enough for what, one wonders. This feels consequential. It felt urgent. And the billboard was not super helpful because while there was a very attractive woman on the billboard, her teeth were not showing. I could not make a proper assessment of what it meant. These narratives that are handed to us with such urgency, these pressing demands, this is true, this is the way it is. We don't have to grant the premise of these questions, friends. We do not have to add the sex appeal of our teeth to the many anxieties that are already on our plate in a given day. We can let one go by us. We can say, you know what, that's actually not normal. That's not a thing. I don't have to acknowledge that. And yet, the narratives, especially around technology, are placed on us, pressed to us with such a sense of settled inevitability that we actually find it difficult to sort of raise our hands and say, should we be doing this? Is this good for us? Is this turning us into better people? Because we are already meant to understand, no, we already had that conversation. We've already had the meetings. We did a study. This is normal now. This is what it is. In fact, the computer scientist who invented a primitive chatbot 60 years ago, a guy named Joseph Weizenbaum, he said that the message that technology is inevitable, that it serves to anesthetize, it serves as a tranquilizer to our conscience, because we are told this is the way that it is. It removes responsibility from our shoulders. You don't have to make that evaluation because it already just is. This morning, I want us to accept responsibility, because chatbot Jesus is ridiculous, and so we are tempted to respond with ridicule. And frankly, chatbot Jesus is outrageous, and so we are tempted to respond with outrage. But I want us to slow down and show our work just enough so that we might actually find moral wisdom here, something that our world desperately lacks, something that we desperately lack in a world that presents us with foolishness. And so looking at our New Testament passage, Peter gives us some helpful language. He says, we have been redeemed from an empty way of life. That word empty means vain, useless, futile. It actually has its roots all the way down in the idea of gnawing on your own tongue instead of food. That's a good start. So we can say it. AI Jesus is not real, right? He is artificial. He is not a he is an it. It does not have thoughts or emotions. Chatbot Jesus is definitionally an idol. It is an image that demands payment or sacrifice. It is an image that projects itself as something with substance and agency, but is actually empty and artificial. It reminds me of an apocryphal story of the prophet Daniel. This is not in the Old Testament. It was written after the time of the Old Testament. But the story is set in Persia, and the Persians are worshiping an idol called Bel. And Daniel observes the statue of Bel and says, you know, guys, I don't think this is real. It's just clay and bronze. This is not a real God, and it's certainly not consuming all of the food and wine that you're sacrificing to it every day. And so Daniel sets up a test. He spreads ashes all over the floor of the temple so that the next day when the king and everyone walks in and all of the food and wine are gone, you can see the footprints of all the priests who come in the night and take it all away and eat all the food and drink all the wine. It's kind of a clever story. It's like an early CSI sort of thing. We might think of our task then as being a little bit like Daniel's. It's our job to help everyone see the footprints and recognize the deception. Now, you guys know Jed is our resident art buff. He's also generally pretty buff. But we often see, and when Jed preaches, he'll show us paintings, right? Renaissance biblical paintings. And it has inspired me to play a little game this morning called Classical Renaissance Biblical Art or AI Image. Are we ready? We've got one. All right. Take a moment. You can't consult with the people next to you, all right? Eyes on your own papers, everyone. Take a moment and think. The one on the right. That's Rembrandt. Yeah, that's real. The one on the left, that's my friend Chat. ChatGPT made that one for me in about 10 seconds. Just made it. All right, let's do another one. All right. Take a minute. Yeah, I know. I really dialed this one in a little bit more. I took 48 seconds on this one. The one on the right is the real one. That's Bernardino May. He's Italian, probably. Is this a fun game? Is it a depressing game? You know, sometimes the line between fun and depressing, it can be a little bit blurry. I chaperoned a high school prom last night, and so I got to witness, you know, what is presented as fun and what is also probably depressing. Like, there's some overlap in those two things. The point is, we're moving toward a world where we're not going to be able to tell the difference. Like, we're just not. It's not going to be true that we're going to be able to point to the footprints and say, see, it's obviously fake, right? We are not going to live in a world where we know if our friend's email was written by an AI agent or them. We're just not going to know. We're not going to know if the song that we find ourselves tapping our toe to is written by a person or if it's generated out of nothingness. We're not going to be able to tell. And so when the difference between the artificial and the actual becomes imperceptible, and there's no footprints left, how do we keep people from being deceived? I hate to tell you this, but like, the problem is actually harder than that. And our task is actually more challenging than that, because the problem is actually not that people are being deceived about whether something is fake or real. The problem is that increasingly people no longer recognize an important distinction between what is fake and real. Increasingly, people are asking with a straight face, what is the difference? What does it matter? Right? What does it matter if I write this or an LLM does? It's the same thing. Who cares if this song was made by a person or the ether? It's the same thing. Increasingly, people prefer the artificial. They seek it out. They choose it. There was a study done a couple of years ago that said after generating ideas, people use LLMs and AI most for companionship, for therapy. A third of teenagers reported that they have chosen an AI companion over friends or parents for a serious conversation that they thought they needed to have. Anyone turning to chatbot Jesus is not confused about whether or not this is real. They don't believe that there is a webcam up at the right hand of the Father and Jesus is zooming in with them. They understand the terms of service and they have accepted them. And so actually, this is not like the story of Daniel. This is Exodus 32. This is the people bowing down to the golden calf at the base of Mount Sinai. Because in that story, if you remember, the people took all of their own gold, they handed it to Aaron, it was cast in front of their eyes into a golden calf, and then they said with a straight face, "Look, that's our God." Are they just stupid? Is this collective amnesia? It is a willful self-deception. Those who would bow down to the golden calf, those who would pray to chatbot Jesus, believe whatever a God is supposed to be or do for us. A fake God is essentially the same. A fake God is able to do for me what I hope a real God can do. That is a troubling conclusion to arrive at. This is why I am saying it's not enough for us to be able to smirk dismissively at chatbot Jesus. This is symptomatic of a much larger condition that goes beyond a goofy headline. This is about understanding the empty way of life, our tragic tendency to gnaw on our tongues while we die of hunger. The task here is not about rejecting a technology. It is about understanding and naming the malformation of our desires and trying to recover what it is we're made for. And this is our on-ramp to the road to Emmaus. It's interesting, in Luke's gospel, there are three little passages about the resurrection, but this one is the longest. This is the centerpiece for how Luke wants to show us the risen Christ. And it's with these two men that are walking 7 miles from Jerusalem to Emmaus. Now, as they're walking, what we see in the passage, it gets reiterated, they are talking with each other. And that word talking is used twice here, but it's actually a rare word in the New Testament. It's not like other forms of talking. It's about presence and company with one another, about being together. This is the kind of talking and kind of conversation that cannot happen over a text or in the 5 minutes before church starts. This is like the dorm room late night hang kind of conversation, like the what if the colors I see aren't the colors you see kind of conversation. Maybe you never had that one, but the later it gets in the night, the more plausible that conversation becomes. This is the walk in the woods conversation. This is the road trip kind of conversation. In their case, literally. It's the kind of conversation that has a tide to it. It has an ebb and flow over the course of hours. In fact, when Jesus comes along and he says, "What are you guys discussing?" That word there is actually, "What are you tossing back and forth? What are you batting about between the two of you?" What we see here on the road is that there is time and space for dialogue, not just statically presented ideas and feelings bouncing off one another, but an active, moving presence between people. And Jesus enters into that, right? He doesn't disrupt it. He comes alongside it. And we don't get any explanation for how this works, but the text says that their eyes were kept, they were held from recognizing who Jesus was. And I think that it is important to realize that, the terms on which they meet the risen Jesus here, right? They don't get to know who he is. Instead, they have to meet him in a moment of pure encounter. And as he asks them questions and they respond, there's again this back and forth. Jesus hears and listens, and he does what no chatbot would ever do. He disagrees. He fights back with them. He says, "Really? That's what you think? You foolish people." And he begins to converse with them more, so much so that as he's going to go further down the road, they say, no, we don't want this moment to end. Stay here with us. And they sit down, and Jesus breaks the bread. And in the same moment, they simultaneously have their eyes opened and recognize him. And then Jesus disappears. It's the only time that word is used in the Bible, just vanishes into thin air. These two men look at each other and they say, "Did not our hearts burn within us when he was here?" That's what we're longing for. We want the burning in our hearts. Whatever it is we're seeking, however it is we seek it in the world, that's what we're after, this burning in our hearts. And these men find it here with Jesus. And so the question that it drives us to is, what do they find with the real risen Jesus that could not be found with the artificial? This week, I was sort of mentally crushed by that question. Because on the one hand, it's totally obvious. Jesus is real, and that's fake. But how do we articulate that in a world that says, yeah, I don't actually care about that distinction anymore? How do we make a distinction where one is not being made anymore? I was flailing about, like, pretty pathetically. And honestly, truthfully, God drew my eyes to my bookshelf while I was, like, in my head. And my eyes landed on the spine of a book that had sat there for 20 years. It was a little book by a Jewish philosopher named Martin Buber called I and Thou. And, like, it was a lifeline. I am truly, like, grateful to God for throwing it in my path. If you want to end up in some tall grass this week, you can find this book, I and Thou, and chew on it in very small bites. But it's incredible. Because he offers this vocabulary of this dichotomy. He says we can move through the world in the I-it or the I-thou or the I-you. He says the I-it world is a way of understanding reality where the I is this very big, very important figure, right? That we are full of feeling and intuition and soul and spirit, and we are sent on a quest in the world to know and become ourselves. That is what we're doing here. You could describe it as a quest to find the burning in our hearts. And so in that pursuit, everything out there is an it. It is something that can be acquired or used in that quest. And so in the I-it world, we navigate our lives in a way that is detached and as mediated as possible, because what we want in our interaction with the world is for everything to be as smooth and frictionless as possible, because then it can reflect back to us our image more clearly. And so if you've ever had that nagging thought about, why is it that I find myself preferring to text someone instead of just call? Why is it that I find it easier for me to post on Reddit or on Instagram instead of, like, gather friends and have a conversation with them? That is that impulse. It is, we can say it's just more efficient. It's just more convenient for me to do that. But really, it is that our world tilts us toward detached and mediated experiences. It tilts us toward viewing everything around us as data to process or tools that we can leverage. And if you're thinking, well, that sounds not great, I don't think that's right, well, you are correct, and you get the gold star today. This is a fundamentally anti-human way of existing. And I'm not exaggerating or using metaphor to say it is actually a satanic, demonic way of being, because its promise is to make us like God. We will have perfect knowledge, but its actual end is to separate us, to detach us from everything, from ourselves, from nature, from others, from God. That is the definition of hell. That is where we find ourselves. And so this accounts for why people no longer care to see a difference between what is fake and what is real, between the artificial and the actual, because if the surface is the same, then it serves the same utility. Therefore, it is the same, right? If I cannot detect the difference between an AI-generated song and a real one because they do the same thing to me and for me, then they are the same. If I cannot detect the kindness and support of my friend from the affection of a chatbot, if I can't detect that difference, then no difference exists, because everything out there is essentially an it. And chatbot Jesus, like the golden calf, is the crowning achievement of the it world, because idols create for us a hyper-reality, something that we know to be a simulation. We know that it is fake, and nonetheless, we can enter fully into it. We can project ourselves fully onto it. The hyper-real is a shell of a god we can pour ourselves into, not knowing that it is actually a prison cell that locks shut behind us. But thanks be to God, that is not what these men find on the road to Emmaus in the risen Christ. Our God is a God of encounter. That is what God offers us. The alternative to the I-it world is the I and thou world, the I and the you, where we move through the world that is not empty and tongue-gnawing and idol-making, but it is the way of encounter, of being in the world and seeing and recognizing and naming a you that exists outside of us. Not just an I, not just an it. And the you that is out there cannot be experienced, cannot be known, but only met, only encountered, only loved. We can only discover the you in relationship. And that's what we see with these men on the road to Emmaus. They experience through encounter that thing that is called reciprocity. It's something so much more complex and mysterious and holy than possession or utility. But reciprocity invites us out of clean detachment that we think we want, and instead offers us into something that is much more messy, much more entangled, and something that will definitely weigh us down. But encounter with another, discovering a you, weighs us down with the weight of glory, beholding and marveling at what cannot be possessed, but only encountered and loved. Encounter renders useless our self-made project to find some interior meaning in our lives. Because what could matter less compared to the glory of the substance and the meaning of the world that we encounter around us in other people, in nature, in God? It makes that inward search completely irrelevant. We are called to live in a world that we don't have to interpret or leverage or even be able to hold on to long enough to understand. And we recognize that every attempt we have made to manufacture the burning in our hearts has only left us as cold as a bronze statue. And through encounter, we find what can only be received as a grace and a gift. When Jesus breaks the bread and he opens their eyes and vanishes in the same moment, they say, "Did not our hearts burn within us?" In other words, whatever it means to be a person, we found it right here. It happened through this encounter. Now, they don't get to possess it. They don't get to understand it. They don't even get to experience it for that long. But Jesus offers them a God that they can see and that they can come to love. Jesus vanished from their sight, and even though it was just a glimpse, that's the fundamental difference, that the idol offers us a God that we can fully know, but never experience, never encounter. But Jesus offers us a God that we can never fully know, but that we can only encounter. We can only encounter God. We cannot understand God. We cannot possess God. We certainly cannot use God. We can only encounter him. And so Peter writes basically the same idea. You were not redeemed through the means of possession and utility. You were not redeemed by the stuff of gold and silver. You were redeemed by relationship. You were redeemed by the precious blood of the living Christ. And so I probably wasn't actually worried that any of us were going to go home and check in with Chatbot Jesus today. That was unlikely. That's still probably a small percentile chance. But even still, I want to encourage us in the difficult and necessary work of resisting the anti-human project that turns others into its, that prefers detachment to connection, that invites us away from the things of this world and toward a hyper-reality of idolatry. We do not have to accept the premise of the stories we have been told and will continue to hear about what's going to make us feel whole and what's going to make us feel good. We can act with conviction and intention and build lives and communities that move us away from the it world and draw us toward encounter with God and with one another. And y'all, we have 5 more weeks of Easter. why don't you set up Emmaus moments in your weeks throughout these 5 weeks? Chances for meandering back and forth conversations to happen. Invite someone over for dinner. Let yourself stay up late into the night talking. Laugh with those who laugh. Weep with those who weep. And see if, as you're walking down the road with others, you don't notice the presence of Christ coming alongside you. See if your heart does not burn within you. When we come to the table, we usually emphasize the present encounter. That when you come and receive at this table, that Jesus promises to be here with you, that he offers you his presence and grace in this moment, and that is still absolutely true, and that happens today. But this morning, as you come to the table, I actually want you to look back. I want you to remember. Remember and set up in your heart the moment of encounter that you had with the risen Christ. When in your life did that happen for you? It might have just been a fleeting moment, just like it was for these two men. But when did you see the risen Christ? When was he present with you? When did your heart burn within you? And then as you receive this morning, ask, pray to have that encounter again. Pray for that moment, that experience, that being withness with Jesus. And then as you go out from this place this morning, pray that you might offer that presence to others. We have not been called to offer anything else. We have nothing else, no power, no knowledge, no product. Through Jesus Christ, through his Holy Spirit, we offer his presence for the sake of the world. Amen.